What's up there, good peoples? Cameron Norfleet, Century 21 All Points Realty. And I want to thank you for taking the time out of your day to hear what I've got to say. Before we get started on today's outstanding, excellent podcast interview here, I want to mention that if you are listening to this on a link that someone shared with you, excellent. Tell them I said thank you for sharing the link. However, you definitely want to go to Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or something like that, just so that you can subscribe to the show, subscribe to the podcast. It's great to listen to it, you know, with the link for today, you know, but I think that after you listen to this podcast episode, you'll definitely want to, just so that you can stay up on current events here in the state of Connecticut, what's going on in the real estate market, so on and so forth. You'll have access to all these interviews. You want to subscribe to the podcast, and you can do that by going to those platforms that I just mentioned, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartRadio, pretty much anywhere, any major podcasting platform, I'm there. Also, if you're not following me on Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, Twitter, LinkedIn, pretty much all those major social media networks, you're missing out. I put out a lot of good local informative educational content on these platforms. Right on Facebook, you just look me up, Cameron Norfleet, the Investor Realtor. Cameron Norfleet, the Investor Realtor. Also, Instagram is just Cameron Norfleet. YouTube, just type in Cameron Norfleet and you'll find me there as well. So today's episode is with David Haberfeld. David is a local real estate investor here in the state of Connecticut. He owns many, many properties. He's done flipping. He's done wholesaling. He's done, he owns, like I said, many, many properties. Very experienced, very knowledgeable, and he gives some serious gems throughout this entire podcast episode. We talked about everything from tenant screening to wholesaling to flipping properties to analyzing deals. There's so much that we covered, and you know, he's a wealth of stories, you know, with all of his experience. He's got stories for days that you can definitely learn from. So great episode, great podcast episode we got here today. You're in for a treat. So without further ado, let's get into the interview. David Haberfeld, how are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
All right, I'm doing well. Doing well. I did say your name right?
Yep, that's it.
Nice, awesome. All right, so listen, how did you get into to real estate?
In the very beginning.
In the very beginning. Let's take it from the beginning.
2006. Okay. I got to watch the real estate market climb. Like crazy in like 2003, 2004, 2005, and I didn't know what to do about it. You know, I had no experience in it. And a friend of mine from high school, my best friend from high school, came back from college around then. We reconnected on MySpace, if you remember that.
I remember MySpace.
And we reconnected at the bar. This is in 2006. And we realized that we both had a similar dream. We're like, hey, we want to own rental properties and have residual income. And so we were at the bar drinking, and it was like a bar napkin deal. We decided that we would each buy a 3-family house, but we would be partners on them, and we would have half the risk and half the reward. And you know, we would each live in one, and that was what we were going to do. And we followed through with it. We did it, and we bought so 2-3 families in 2007.
And you both had ownership in both properties, or you had yours and he had his?
So no, our names were, we put both of each other on the deeds. So okay. We both knew together.
Cool.
And he was, he was a good friend, and you know, it worked out great. We're still great friends today. Even though the investments didn't go that well.
Sometimes that happens. Yeah.
Yeah. Just because of the time.
Do you guys still do any, joint ventures, with each other or not so much?
Well, we actually still have one of the 3 families. One of the 3 families, it didn't go well. We had to do like a modification thing, but and one of them we lost. So
okay. Oh, so when you say you lost it, like lost it to foreclosure?
Lost it to foreclosure. Yep.
Okay. Ooh, okay.
So 2012, I think we lost it. So back then, you know, just for people that are listening, everyone's familiar with today's prices, but $280,000 for a 3-family was very normal back in 2006 and 2007. That was what everyone was paying. And if you didn't pay it, someone else would.
Right.
And the market's pretty hot now, but
280 for a three family was like average back then. It wasn't even that special. And the interest rates were not like they are today. So $280,000 today at 3.5% is a lot different than $280,000 in 2006 at 7%.
Right. For sure. For sure. Wow. And so now today, I know you own several properties. Do you buy and hold? Do you also wholesale? Do you flip properties? What exactly do you do in real estate?
So I'm pretty adaptable. I adapt with the market. So when I started, I was rentals only. Equity wasn't a real thing. You know, if you buy it 280, you can't sell it 285. It doesn't work, you know. So I was looking for cash flow, but I didn't know how to calculate the cash flow, which is why I bought $280,000 three times. So, but once I figured out how to calculate the cash flow, equity didn't even exist to me until like 2013 or 14. I bought a few houses, but I never sold anything. And finding the money was so hard back then. Right. So 2013 or 14, I finally sold this little one bedroom condo. It was my first sale ever. And I started realizing that, like, hey, you can sell some of these, you know, that was completely foreign to me. Because remember, when I started, you couldn't sell anything. I wasn't in a position to sell anything. Gotcha. When the market crashed, you couldn't sell anything.
Right.
And so I started flipping houses. And so as the prices of rental units went up, I stopped buying many rentals and started flipping. And I kept the majority of my rental portfolio. And I, you know, try to adapt with the market. You know, if the market was to crash because of the virus, the last downturn, you couldn't flip through the downturn. You could, you can be a landlord through the downturn, but you can't flip through it. So if it looks, if the next downturn looks like the last downturn, we could run into that again, and you want to be adaptable.
Right. Right. And I definitely want to get into that a little bit later on, as far as, you know, the current environment that we're in right now. I just want to talk a little bit about your first deal, your first few deals. How did you get into it? How did you finance them? Because I know a lot of people these days, you know, that they kind of struggle with, coming up with the money or the, you know, the credit, just, you know, whatever their situation is. How do I break into this game? So how did you finance your first few deals? If you just want to kind of, you know, dive as deep as you feel comfortable into how you finance those deals.
Sure. Well, this is actually not a very interesting story. So I had a good job and I paid my bills. So I had good credit.
That's awesome. It really is. You know, and not to cut you off, but I mean, there's, you know, a lot of times people have bad credit and they haven't saved the money, you know, to get into real estate. And so they're looking for another way to get in, you know, but the best way is to protect your credit and save some money. You know what I mean? That's the best way to do it. But go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
Oh, no, that's all right. So, you know, I went to the bank and I said, I'd like to buy a house. And they said, sure. Are you, you know, can you fog this mirror? And I put fog on the mirror and that was approved. Nice. And I bought a house and I actually bought like three that way. Not knowing that wasn't like, you know, not knowing that I was like not supposed to live in a wall. I was supposed to, there's supposed to be investment after that, but everybody's doing it. And I was young. I didn't know.
Right.
And that's how I got the first ones. I just signed my name on the dotted line.
Right. Because back then, I mean, pretty much they were giving money away to
or
whoever applied. You know, it was definitely a different market, you know.
Yeah. Very irresponsible of them.
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. And that's what happened in 2008. We got paid for that, you know.
Yep.
So tell us a little bit about your, since then, like I said, you've done several deals, you know, owned several properties, done flips and so on and so forth. Tell us a bit about your best and your worst deal.
God, there's a couple of worst deals. I'm not sure which one is.
Well, just tell us about something that people can really learn from.
You know, I got a good one that people can learn from. And actually, you know what? This, I don't know if it's my best, but it's the best story for sure.
Okay,
so,
cool.
It's the busy time. You know, foreclosures are all over the place, and you can pick up houses pretty cheap. It's like 2012 or 13, something like that. And I get a call from a realtor friend, a commercial realtor, And she says, David, there's this house out in Vernon, and it's $15,000. And it's in bad shape, needs everything, but it's $15,000. And I'm like, oh. And she's like, go look at it. And I was so busy. I was literally running every day, every single day, morning till night. And Vernon is 40 minutes, 45 minutes from me. And I couldn't go. And she's like, David, you're gonna lose it if you don't go. You gotta go. And I didn't go. And I said, Jesus, the land has got to be worth $15,000, right?
Right.
And so I said, I'll take it, sight unseen. It was the first time I had ever did that. So I buy it. And my lawyer happens to have some kind of errand up that way. And he goes and looks at it. And he says, David, you sure you want this thing for $15,000? And I'm like, my lawyer is Aaron Sarah in Plainville. Very happy with him. He's a good real estate lawyer.
Good.
And I'm like, yeah, Aaron, of course I do. It's only $15,000. That's like free, right? And so he's like, okay. And I end up buying it, and I actually put it on a credit card. So this is one of the good stories. So it was $15,000, and I didn't have any money. So I wanted to put it on a credit card, but I didn't have $15,000 of room on my credit card. So I actually borrowed a friend's credit card. So I bought it for zero out of pocket. And it was all on a credit card that wasn't my credit card with 0% for like, it was like 8 months or 9 months. So that was, that wasn't out of pocket, but I got up there and I realized that the land was like this huge hill. It was actually really bad. It was a really bad lot on top of a really bad house. And I figured out pretty quickly that I might have overpaid for this.
At 15,000.
At 15,000. Yeah, this is a house that, you know, the right price for this house would be zero.
right.
So I don't fix it. And I'm working on other projects, and it's just kind of sitting there. You know, I'm burning through a little insurance, burning through a little tax money. And the city starts getting on me. One thing that I didn't figure out in my due diligence is that the house happens to be on the mayor's way to work.
Oh, goodness.
How are you going to figure that out, right? So I start getting pressure from the building department. And I said, listen, I'm not ready to do anything here. The house is secure, but I'm not ready to do anything. And they said, you know, well, you have to knock it down then. I said, I'm not knocking it down. Knock down houses don't make any money.
Right.
So I didn't do anything. And then one day out of the blue, it was a windy day. Not even a storm though. A tree falls right on the house. And wow. I was like, oh no, I didn't put building insurance on it.
Oh, goodness,
because the house was in such bad shape that I didn't put building insurance on it, because what could possibly happen to the house to make it in worse shape than I got it? And the answer to that question is a tree falling on it, by the way.
So you found out.
So I call my insurance agent and I say, Shirley, is there anything we could do? And Shirley says, oh, David, don't you remember? When you told me not to put building insurance on it, I called you back and I said, but building insurance was only another $80 for every 6 months. So you said, go ahead. And I was like, oh my God, thank you for not listening to me, Shirley. So this is a story about being lucky is better than being good.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had building coverage. The insurance claim was $37,000. And then I listed it on the market for $7,000 with the same realtor and sold it in like one day.
Wow.
And I walked away. So that's one of my favorite real estate stories. Don't recommend doing that to anyone. It's really hard to get the tree to fall over without doing something bad.
So, illegal, right?
Yeah.
Wow. Let's give Shirley a shout out. Who's Shirley?
Shirley Sullivan, Brown and Brown Insurance.
Nice. Thank you, Shirley, for that. Awesome. So let me ask you this. What do you wish you knew when you first started out?
I wish I knew how to do the math. That's an easy one. I did not know how to calculate cash flow when I started, and I didn't have any mentors. I didn't know what a mentor was. It didn't even occur to me to ask someone who was successful in what I wanted to do, how to do it. I just went and tried to figure it out myself, which was one of my more significant regrets in life, honestly, is that I learned so many things the hard way.
Right.
But just learning how to calculate cash flow is super important, and not leave out the things that matter. You know, a lot of people are like, well, my mortgage is this, my insurance is this, my taxes are this, the rest is profit, right? And that's just not
the case. A very common mistake. Very, very common mistake. You know,
everyone,
and you know, it's unfortunate.
Yeah. Right. New guys are like, hey, I can make $1,500 a month on this three family. And I'm like, where's your vacancy rate? Where's your repair right. rate? Are right. you going to manage it yourself? Okay, you're going to manage it yourself. Did you pay your water bill? Did you pay any other utilities? You know, right. did you mow your lawn? Right. Like, you know,
right. nothing. CapEx, you know, eventually you got to put a roof on it. You got to buy, you know, some boilers. You got to redo the driveway. I mean, you know, a lot of things that people just don't calculate, you know, it's unfortunate, but you know, I mean, on the flip side of that, they eventually become motivated sellers. You know what I mean? So
they will one day, unfortunately. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah. That's definitely, definitely important. any other like mistakes or anything that you think that, other people can learn from, just, you know, in your journey?
Yeah, I got a couple.
Sure.
One, don't partner if you don't need a partner. If you need money, you don't necessarily need a partner. You probably need a lender. If you need a deal, you know, you need a house. You don't need a partner. You know, if right. you need a contractor, you need someone to fix it. You don't necessarily need a partner. Partnerships can make sense, but more often than not, people get into partnerships out of fear, or they become partners when they could be, you know, when they could hire someone. So don't be overly anxious to jump into a partnership. That's one of the things that I've learned and always tell others.
Nice.
The other thing I learned is contractors. Like, you know, it's really important to choose good contractors. Contractors are not created equal. And I'll give you a really good example. I am a licensed contractor. I own a hammer and some screwdrivers. I'm not handy. I never have been. I've always recognized it as a weakness of mine. Mm-hmm. I'm just not handy. It actually turns out to be a strength, because now I can do a lot by not doing anything myself.
Right.
And so to be a contractor, you have to send in your money, and you're a contractor. There is no test. There's no requirement of skills or knowledge. So I can go to your house and say, give me a deposit and I will do this contractor work for you. And I don't know anything. Right. I know enough to be dangerous probably if I was to do it myself.
Right. Whole state of Connecticut, right?
Never hire a contractor that you don't know. The best way to get a contractor is to ask your friends who you've used that you had a good experience with.
Right. That's excellent advice. That's excellent advice. I mean, and that's an excellent, not analogy, but that, you know, just the fact that you, like you said, you have a contractor's license and you don't know anything about construction.
I should not be allowed to be a contractor. If you asked me, if I was in charge of things, I wouldn't want someone like me to come and collect deposits and try to do work at other people's houses. You know, it's just not it's not proper. There should be some tests, you know. And this is, by the way, this is only the home improvement contractors. This does not apply to electricians, plumbers, HVAC. Those guys have to go to a lot of school. If they have a license, that license means something.
Right, right, for sure, for sure. Awesome. How about tenants? Have you had I'm sure you have, you know, stories, lessons, things that you've learned from just, you know, tenants over the years? Some war stories that you've kind of gone through with that.
I mean, how much time you got?
We got a little bit of time.
The best advice that I can give about tenants is to look at everybody individually. Unless you're a huge company with a ton of units, you have the ability to look at every application individually. First of all, screen. If you don't screen is a requirement of the industry. It's not optional. If you're not screening, what are you even doing here? Every application, learn how to read them and what they mean. Have someone teach you. So as an example, someone comes into me with bad credit and I look at their credit report and it has student loans on it that are bad and medical bills on it that are bad. And I might still take them because everyone pays their rent before they pay their back student loans or they pay their back medical bills, right?
For sure.
Because when you want to go to school, you know, you just sign. And that's normal, you know? I mean, I think a lot of us did it. And when you're sick, the only thing that matters is getting better. You're not thinking about what it costs, right. You know? And so they make you better, and you can't afford the bill. I mean, that happens, you know?
Right.
On the opposite side, if you have people that have utilities in collections or car repossessions, I take those a lot more seriously because some people will pay their electricity and their car bill before they pay their rent. And that means they have really real financial problems. Also criminal stuff. You know, how long has it been? What was the offense? I usually right. turn down anything drug related and things like sex offenders and serious stuff, but yep. you know, I'll take felons if it's been a long time and if the
it's forgivable. You know, if someone had a you know, a serious assault or a gun charge when they were a teenager and now they're 35 and they've been clean for 10, 15 years. I mean, you know, the odds are they're probably all right. You know, they made right. some mistakes when they were young and everybody deserves a second chance if you believe that they have, you know, become a, you know, not going to make the same mistakes. Drugs are less so. If someone has a drug charge on their record, and I'm not talking about weed, if they have a drug charge, there's only two reasons to have drugs. You are either using them or you are selling them. So I've actually asked tenants, which one is it? Were you using or selling? And some of them are very surprised that I asked that. Mm. But, you know, if they say it's their friend's drugs and they were holding them, you know that's a lie, right? So I ask them the answer, and some of them are like, you know, I've been clean for a year, or, you know, I was selling them, but I, you know, went to jail, and I, you know, you have to take it on a case-by-case basis. I have taken... Yeah. I have taken former drug dealers if I truly believe that they're reformed, and I've usually been right. Drug addicts, I've taken a couple with good results, but I've taken more with bad results. You never know when they're going to fall off the wagon. It's in Connecticut especially, it's just safer to stay away and wait for the next tenant, which is, I feel bad for them, especially if they've been working hard at it. But in Connecticut, evictions are so hard that you can't take the chance safely.
Right.
So, you know, screen everyone individually. Also, illegal immigrants. Illegal immigrants, always such a hot button issue, but there's no law that a landlord cannot rent to an illegal immigrant. You can believe that, you know, people should come across the border legally, but it's, they still have to live somewhere while they're here. It's not your job to deport them. And illegal immigrants have actually made really good tenants for me. I've only had a couple, maybe like three or four over the years, but they've worked hard, they pay their bills, they don't want any trouble, and they've made good tenants. So I'm not a whenever someone's like, oh, you can't rent to them, they're illegal, I'll stand up for them and say, yes, you can.
Right, right. Nice. And I feel the same way, you know, with my rentals, you know, as far as, you know, credit card debt and, like I said, hospital bills and all that, you know, I can kind of, for the most part, I can kind of look past all that stuff. But when you've been evicted, you know, I don't look past evictions. When I see that you've had a car repossessed or several cars repossessed, I can't look past that, you know, because you need these things in order to live, you know, in today's society, it's very hard, at least, you know, around here, you know, in Connecticut, many times it's very hard, you know, as an adult to survive when you don't have a car. You know, you can do it, you know, and you can use the bus and things of that nature. But when you have a vehicle and you let it go via repossession, that kind of says something as far as your priorities are concerned, you know? So, it, for me, you know, as far as repossessions, it's not generally a, absolutely not, but it's a huge red flag. Evictions, I don't do evictions, personally. But that's good though. That's good. What advice would you give to someone that's starting out? In other words, they haven't even done their first deal. And they don't even know what type of deal they want to do. They don't know if they want to get into flipping, wholesaling, or, you know, buy and hold or what have you. What type of advice would you give to someone in those shoes?
My advice is to buy a rental and live in it for your first move. Mm-hmm. A lot of people think that they should get into wholesaling because wholesaling has a low barrier to entry for their first deal. They don't need to spend a lot of money on marketing or even no money. They just Facebook advertise. Wholesaling is not as easy as it sounds.
I agree 100%.
It is not you just find a deal and sell it to someone for more. It's like harder than that, you know?
Right. Absolutely.
Buying a three family and living in one unit or not and getting the cash flow from it with an owner-occupied mortgage is the first step that I recommend to everyone. You will learn so much. And, you know, if you don't make money on that first deal, I mean, you better learn how to do the cash flow calculation beforehand. But once you do, I mean, that's a solid first investment. And then by the time you learn some of those lessons, you'll be ready for your second.
Right, for sure. Definitely. And I agree, you know, and I've said this many, many times before, rather be on my, my YouTube channel, podcast, Instagram, so on and so forth, you know, as far as wholesaling is concerned, wholesaling makes people a lot of money if you're selling the course. You know, wholesaling is a great way to make money for the gurus. Not saying that you can't make money in wholesaling. I mean, people do it every day, you know, but it's just not as easy and straightforward as they make it sound. You know, I mean, they pretty much say, you know, oh, you want $10,000? Find a motivated seller, find a buyer, connect them, you sell them the contract, you got your $10,000. Sounds so easy.
Sounds so easy.
That's why it sells courses.
I need 20, so I'm going to do that twice today.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just crazy. But again, it happens, you know, that there are plenty successful wholesalers out there that just do wholesaling. It's just not as easy as people make it out to be. You touched quickly on joint ventures. Do you do joint ventures now? And if so, like, what are you looking for in a partner?
I do. I actually do a lot of partnerships, even though I said I'm partnership adverse. So I'll never have a partner in everything. Right. When I take on a partner, it's because the person brought me something that I couldn't get on my own. Mm-hmm. So as an example, you know, someone contacts me and says, hey, I want to do this flip. I found it. I have under contract. I don't want to sell it, but I need help. And this is what I need. Would you partner with me on it? That's a maybe. If they won't sell it to me, if I can't buy it from them, if I want to be in that deal and it's a good deal, and I have to partner with them, I'll consider them for that one deal. And so I've had mostly success stories with that. And I do two or three of those a year, and they're deals I couldn't do without. So,
right.
You have to bring me something that I can't get on my own.
Right. How do you usually structure those?
They're all a little different depending on the circumstances. You know, I guess, like one of the last ones, my friend Jeff, he brought me a two family that was listed on the market in my town, by the way, but it was such a crappy house that I wasn't interested, like, for any price, you know. It was a really poor house. And he's like, hey, no, I still think there's money in this. And I'm like, yeah, it's skinny money. I mean, it was priced right, you know, but it was just not a desirable house. What are you going to do with it? Keep it as a rental. It doesn't make sense. It doesn't make very much money. And to sell it, we're going to run into the same problem. It's still an undesirable house. So he actually negotiated it down so far, that farther than I would have even thought to ask. And the guy said yes. And so he had it under contract for such a great price. But he couldn't afford to do the deal on his own, and he didn't have management in place because it was a two-family with a tenant in it. And so he asked me to partner with him, and I said yes. So I put up half the money, 50-50, and I actually just managed it because I already had the structure and it was in my town, and I did the renovations on it because I had the structure and it was in my town. And, you know, we went to sell it, and it did take a long time to sell because it was undesirable, but we did eventually find the right person for it and sold it and made a profit. And it was that was a deal that I said no to, and I was wrong. He talked me into it, and he was right.
Cool. And that's with this experience that you have now. I'm assuming that's somewhat recently, or
yeah, that was recent. That was last year.
Nice, yeah. Nice. So you never really get to the point where you know everything.
I don't know anyone that knows everything. I only know people that think they do.
I know a lot of them. I know a lot of them for sure. With what's going on right now, the whole COVID-19 thing, what should aspiring investors, again, haven't necessarily done any deals at this point, what should they be doing during this time of you know, social distancing and, you know, what is it, you know, just pretty much staying in your house and so on, there's a word for it. But anyway, what should quarantine. People be doing? Well, yeah, quarantine, there's another, sheltering in place, that's what I was thinking. You know, what should aspiring investors be doing during this time?
So, it's really obvious on Facebook which investors lived through the last downturn and which have never seen a downturn, because this has been a great real estate market, headed like pretty much straight up since like what, 2014, like 6 years in a row.
Yeah, for sure. Yep.
And it's. You know, a lot of people that are in real estate now, anyone who's gotten in the last 6 years, they don't know what the downside looks like. And I know they've heard of it, but they've never felt it, you know?
Right.
And so it's really obvious on Facebook. You can tell who's not worried about it because they've just never felt it before. So
right.
Anyone looking to flip, my advice is to not use comps to determine value, which is the only way to determine value, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if I buy a house for, you know, if the house is 50 grand and it needs 50 grand to work and the comps say it's worth 150 today, I would buy those all day long, but today I won't because mm-hmm. I don't know if that's going to be worth 150 3 months from now, 6 months from now. I don't know that. I think we are going to have a downturn. I don't think it'll be as bad as 2008, but there are so many factors that lead towards downward pressure. I think we're just believing the rest of the pent-up demand right now. And I think the true factor that makes the difference is lending products.
Mm.
So if the banks say, we're going to keep lending, but you have to have higher credit and you have to have more reserves and you have to have more income to get a house, you know, some of the new guys are like, oh, that's not so bad. You can still get a house. But that actually is really bad. That is a downturn. Mm. Easy lending products make for a good real estate market. Tough lending products means that there's not enough buyers and there's too many houses out there. Right now, the market, the prices haven't changed at all right now. Like, right. This is still a hot market. You can sell a house today. And the reason is people are just waiting to see what happens. A lot of people have pulled their listings from the market. Either they don't want people walking through their houses or they are just waiting for this to blow over before they sell, which is a mistake on their part. But that is what keeping prices up, because there's just not that many houses listed. Reduced supply. Demand is dwindling, but supply is dwindling along with it, so prices mm-hmm. haven't changed.
Gotcha.
But we should be worried about a downturn. I mean, there's just so much job loss. I think the news said that like 4.1 million mortgages are now furloughed. You know, I don't know how many mortgages there are in the country, but that's a lot. That's a big number. And of those 4.1 that are furloughing, how many of those guys are going to start paying when the furlough's over? You know, I mean, there's going to be a new wave of foreclosures. I mean, you know, if it's 2 or 3 million or something like that, I don't think that number is crazy to guess, you know?
Right, right.
It's a new wave of foreclosures, which is not necessarily a bad thing. There's going to be opportunity. Tenants not paying. How many people do you know that got into, they're buying houses on cap rate, especially apartment buildings. And they're like, oh, I got a 9 cap, 10 cap, you know, 8 cap, whatever. What did they write down for their vacancy rate? You know they're all writing 5%, right? Because that's what the bank allows you to write. But you know their vacancy right now, it is 30%, 25%. Mm. You know they can't, how long can they last losing that much money every month?
Right.
And the answer is some of them can last probably forever if they're rich. But some of the guys that are not prepared, some of the guys that were like 100% leveraged or more than 100% leveraged because they wanted to expand, they're not prepared for 25% vacancy for 6 months, you know?
Right.
Eviction
right.
court is going to be backed up for months and months and months. You know, if you have someone that you want to evict right now, today, what's today, May 19th?
Right.
Yep. You have someone you want to evict today, I mean, you might not get them out till November, December, you know? It could be that long. And they just get to live there for free. You don't get your money back. There's no government program for you. You just have to eat that. So you have to take that. Those people are going to come around and some of them are going to bail and they will provide the opportunities. So they're either going to sell them because they can't hang on or they'll be their next round of foreclosures. So my advice to everybody is to be patient. You are not under any pressure to buy deals right now because panic has not set in. Foreclosures have not set in. Prices have not gone down. Interest rates are going to stay low. So my advice is to be patient.
Right, right. I agree with that 100%, man. I really do. You know, and another thing that I've said, and I've kind of gotten pushback on it from some people, I'm interested in knowing how you feel, is goal setting. Personally, I don't do a lot of goal setting in terms of, you know, purchasing property and things of that nature, because the way I feel is that if I was to say I'm going to buy 5, 10, 15, 20 properties, whatever the number is, by the end of the year, once you start getting closer to that time and you feel like you're not going to meet your goal, then you start making bad decisions. You know what I mean? So I don't agree with that type of goal setting. And so to your point, you know, there is no rush. You know, there is no rush to dive in the market now. You know, my thing is, you know, continue to educate yourself. You know, educate yourself on what you're going to get yourself into. Look for deals in the meantime. When you find yourself, you know, a potential good deal or at least something that you can make into a good deal, jump on it, you know. So that, you know, that's my, you know, kind of my two cents on that, you know. Now you are a pretty busy guy. You have, you know, a lot going on with real estate and so on and so forth. I also see you, you know, all the time on social media and so on. How do you, as a guy in your shoes with all the things that you have on your plate, how do you spend your time? What does your day look like with your real estate investing and family and all that good stuff?
So before the virus, I'm busy all the time, but I forced myself to have some fun. But every weeknight, I was either meeting with friends or a networking meeting or an event or, you know, some kind of meeting or happy hour or anything. I was busy all the time.
Right.
And the virus, like, you know, just like everybody else, just really cleared off the schedule. This is strange for me. So there are some times I go to work and I come home and I stay home, and that's just so odd to me. Mm. I have a staff, so that helps me a lot. I do go to the office regularly just to keep some regularness in my life. Is that a word? But I don't necessarily have to. I mean, I could set myself up to work from home if I wanted to, I think. So, right. You know, as far as what my days consist of now, you know, I do enjoy helping other small business owners, you know, that are close to me. And, you know, just giving other advice, and I'm a member of my BNI group and trying to help some of the other businesses that are suffering. That's what I do for Business Networking International. It's a networking group, you know, probably one of the best ones out there, if not the best. So that's kind of what I'm doing for fun, honestly. It's just like,
nice.
You know, helping out others and, you know, just trying to stop some of my friends from going under, you know. I'm finishing up the rest of my rehabs, but I haven't bought anymore. My pipeline is getting skinny. I'm selling off some rentals. One of my goals, and I think one of everyone's goals, should be to raise or find capital to take advantage of opportunities that come later. So finding private money is just as good as having it. For sure. You know, I'm selling off some rentals, and, you know, there are still some buyers out there, so it's going okay. You know, I have a car dealership also. One of my thoughts was to diversify out of real estate a little bit because another downturn was going to come. I just didn't know what it looked like. And a used car dealership is normally recession-proof because people still need to drive and, you know, people tend to not buy new. And so, unfortunately, this car dealers are hit by this because there's so much reduced driving. So car sales are down, repairs are down, accidents are down. I didn't count on that. So I'm trying to make that thing run. It's, you know, run better. So I spend some time there. It's a little more effort than I'd hoped it would be, but, you know, I'm invested in it, so I'm going to keep going.
For sure.
I hope to see some friends and hang out and get some sun this summer. I don't plan on quarantining at home the whole time. I can tell you that.
Right.
I think that, you know, I think that people, you just have to get out at some point. At some point, you're going to be like, you know, I'm better off just licking grocery store doorknobs and getting it, getting better than, you know, than staying home and afraid forever. Because, I mean, it's going to be a long time before this truly leaves society. I mean, you know, it's hard. I don't even want to guess, but it's not happening real soon.
It's not. We're not going to be completely done with this on May 20th is what you're saying.
That's for sure. That's for sure.
Well, yeah, I agree. So, what types of properties are you looking for now? I know you said that you're offloading, but if there is the wholesaler out there or what have you, or what real estate agent or what whatever that's listening to this podcast, what piques your interest now? What types of properties?
I'm looking for rentals with cash flow. Equity is unimportant. Gotcha. So I'm only looking for pretty much rentals with cash flow, or if it's a total steal, you know. Right. But if you show me a three family that makes $1,000 a month, it makes $1,000 a month, whether there's a virus, whether you can sell it, if the house is worth $100,000 or worth $200,000, doesn't matter. If it makes $1,000 a month, it makes $1,000 a month. So I'm looking for cash flow, which is how I started. When I first started, I was only looking for cash flow. I just didn't know how to do the math.
Right.
And I've come full circle, and now I'm looking for cash flow again. Because again, if I buy a house to flip today, I can't tell you what it's going to be worth in 3 or 6 months. You know, right. If it's a lot lower, I don't want to eat that, you know, or if there's no buyers, if lending dries up, what if you can't sell your product because no one can buy it? You know, interest rates are 3%, greatest rates ever, but no one can get a loan. Then what good is that interest rate? You know, and I don't know that's what's going to happen, but I don't want to bet against that and be wrong.
Gotcha. You had touched on the fact that you have employees. Now, in your business structure, how does that look as far as a real estate investor with employees? How does that look for you? Like, as far as like what type of titles do you have? Like, do they all come to an office? Are they remote? Do you have VAs? Like, how does that look for you?
So I have four staff in my office in real estate, and I have five staff at the car dealership. So I have nine total. So at the real estate side, I have a full-time bookkeeper. I have an office manager. I have, and the other two are part-time. One is collections and one is maintenance. And those two are both part-time. Okay. So that's how it's all structured out. When the virus came, I told them all that I really want the office to stay open. We were considered essential, so we could. But I said, I don't want to make any of you work if you're not comfortable. So two of them chose to work from home and two of them chose to keep something coming in. So, you know, and that worked just fine. Honestly, it was fine. Everyone was happy and we continued that way. You know, it's amazing when you get, you know, when you get a little bit of size to you, how you actually need a bookkeeper. You know, just, you think that you just like, you know, balance the checkbook and write checks and stuff, but it's a lot more than that.
Right.
You know, it's a very valuable thing to have. And I do recommend that everybody who is, you know, I mean, if you get up to 30 units, you should have a bookkeeper. You don't need to hire one. You can hire a service.
Right.
It's worth it. It's worth it. Hire a bookkeeper early in your career. And also, if you're not hiring a bookkeeper and you're a new investor, if you don't have an accounting background, you're doing it wrong. I don't even have to know you to know that you're doing something wrong, because we all are. Hire a bookkeeper to keep yourself straight so you don't have any audit exposure in the future, and you're paying the taxes you're supposed to, and you know, you're just doing things right, structuring things right.
Right.
You know, and collections is obvious. She you know, she works a bunch of hours a week just chasing tenants, and maintenance, same thing. You know, something breaks, she takes in the call and she dispatches it to one of dozens of subs that we have on our Rolodex, and we, you know, she gets everything fixed and makes sure it's done. And then the office manager is the one who keeps the office doors open all the time, and she collects the rent, and she, you know, takes in the mail and handles the leases and meets the tenant face to face and, you know, handles everything in person.
Nice. So at this point in your life, is this kind of where you saw yourself being? Did you see yourself, you know, do you feel like, you know, I would have thought I would have been further. Do you see yourself as, wow, I can't believe I'm really here. Like, I didn't expect to have all the success. You know, like, how do you compare up to the person that you thought you would be at this point in your life?
When I was younger, I had no entrepreneurial ambition when I was young, but I was doing things that were entrepreneurial. I just didn't know. I didn't even know what the word was. Like I would buy and sell like baseball cards at school or something like that, you know. Or, you know, one time I went to Costco when I was a kid and I bought the bulk packs of gum and I was selling them for 25 cents, the same prices in the gas stations.
Nice.
To my friends at lunch, things like that, you know, that show that you have entrepreneurial spirit. But my parents were very traditional, you know, go to school, get a job. I didn't have any entrepreneurial friends that I knew of. So, you know, I didn't pursue it at all. And, you know, if you had told me when I was 20 or even 25 that, you know, I would own a ton of real estate and have done a bunch of flips and, you know, be very entrepreneurial. I don't know if I would have believed you, you know.
Nice.
I might not have.
So you're doing well.
I'm pretty happy these days. I can, for the most part, I can kind of do what I want. You know, I'm 41 years old. I worked hard to get here and, you know, tried to work smart also. If I was to look back and see all of the things that I could have done if I started out this way, like if I had a mentor when I was 20, I mean, I would go crazy if I was to.
I think you might be blocking the mic on the phone.
What's that?
I think you might be blocking the mic on the phone. I'm able to hear you, but it was kind of muffled.
I've got a lawnmower. My neighbor's mowing the lawn.
Gotcha.
So if I was to go back and look at like how much I've missed, it would just go crazy. So you can't think about that stuff.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, you know. For sure.
So I mean, I'm happy where I am. Could I have been farther along? Of course. Could I have been doing worse? Of course.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
You know.
So really quick, just going forward, what are your goals from here? Where do you want to go? A person with all that you have, like, what are your goals going forward?
I mean, I guess I'm really seeking more residual income. Residual income is one of those things that everybody talks about, but few people really know what it is.
Right.
You know, I like to call it mailbox money. Mm-hmm. So you just collect money in the mailbox. It just comes to your mailbox. So when you buy a 3-family house and you rent it out and you make $1,000 a month off of it, that is not residual money. You have to earn that. You have to maintain Absolutely. It. You have to work for it. There's no, it's not that residual. It's more residual than working 9 to 5, but it's not residual. Right. So true residual money is one of my goals to, you know, to go after. You know, it'd be nice to make, you know, enough to live on where I can just do that. And I would still work, of course, but I seek out more and more of that these days. And, you know, with mixed results, we'll say.
For sure. Well, listen, I definitely appreciate you taking the time. You know, I know you're busy. I don't want to take too much of your time. So I definitely appreciate you taking the time to speak to me and my audience here on the podcast. So I definitely appreciate that. So if someone wanted to contact you, whether they want to ask you questions, whether they want to bring you deals or whatever the case may be, how would they contact you?
Yeah, I mean, Facebook is great. If they wanted to message me on Facebook, if you want to put up my name on the podcast, or I'll give you my email address, which is david080@yahoo.
Cool.
David080@yahoo.
Cool. And just on Facebook, they can look you up just by putting your name in?
Yep. Cool. Yep. So I check it pretty regularly. You know, if the message goes to the other folder, sometimes I don't get it right away, but.
Right. Awesome. Yeah. Awesome. Well, again, I definitely thank you for taking this time. It's been extremely educational. A lot of great points, a lot of gems dropped today. So I definitely appreciate that. So anything else you want to say before we get out of here?
No, thank you very much. I really appreciate it. I was, you know, it was a pleasure to be on, and, you know, stay safe and, you know, get ready for a great summer. It's a beautiful day out.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right. So for everybody else out there, I definitely thank you for your time. That's all we got for today. Make it a great day.